Safety Code 6. We apologize for the brief delay starting the meeting today. We're just we're moving into the paperless world here on the Hill, and committees is one of the committees are one of the items where we're trying to go paperless. So we're working on that, and as well some presentations. So we're going to start off with Mr. Miller first, Professor Miller, and you can go first if you're ready, sir. And you have about 7 minutes, I believe, the clerk's advice for time. How much time?
10 minutes.
10 minutes. 10 minutes for time. And go right ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to present on Health Canada's review of the evidence for Safety Code 6, which I believe has led to unsafe conclusions. I am a physician epidemiologist specializing in cancer etiology, prevention, and screening. I have performed research on ionizing radiation and cancer, electromagnetic fields and cancer, and other aspects of cancer causation. I have served on many committees assessing carcinogenicity of various exposures, including working groups of the International Agency for Research on Cancer, commonly known as IARC, of which Canada is a member, and I was the first Canadian member of their scientific council. I was visiting senior scientists in the monographs program in IARC in September 2011 until January 2012, where as part of my duties I reviewed the scientific literature which was used by a working group to designate radio frequency fields as a class 2B carcinogen, that is, a possible carcinogen. I was also one of the peer reviewers invited by the Royal Society of Canada to review the draft report of the Royal Society panel on Safety Code 6. I have a number of concerns over the documents that have recently been released by Health Canada on Safety Code 6, Safety Code 6 itself, and the document called Rationale. What Health Canada has said is in its latest iteration of Safety Code 6 is that it should be distinguished from some municipal and or national guidelines that are based on socio-political considerations. I find that a strange statement because it seems to provide no room for emerging evidence on health hazards, which surely should be considered if the safety of humans is the objective. Now, there have, since the IARC review, which identified radio frequency fields as a possible human carcinogen, there have been a number of studies which have been reported, which, in my view, and that of a number of colleagues who've written paper, a couple of papers with me on this issue, one of whom will present to you next week. These studies, we believe, reinforce the evidence that radio frequency fields are not just a possible human carcinogen, but a probable human carcinogen, putting into the category 2A, which it would be impossible to ignore in regulatory approaches to such a hazard. One of the most important, I believe, was a study in France, a large case control study, which found a doubling of risk of glioma, which is the most malignant form of brain tumor, after 2 years of exposure to cell phones, and after 5 years, five times the risk. They also identified the fact that in those who lived in urban environments, where there are probably a number of other carcinogens that could impact upon brain tumours, the risk was even higher. Now, that brings us back to the Safety Code 6 and the document which they, the Health Canada, contracted to produce a review of the evidence. And this was the document produced by the Royal Society panel. I feel that panel was conflicted. As you probably know, the chair changed. The panel had insufficient expertise in epidemiology. My friend Paul Demers was called in to be chair of that panel. I believe he presented to you fairly recently. I feel he was put in an impossible situation. If you read that document carefully, it says that the panel did not have adequate time to do a full review of the data. They therefore relied on reviews of other people, and they did not do a detailed evaluation of the studies. That led them, I believe, to false conclusions. It's important to recognize that there are no safe levels of exposure to human carcinogens. Although risk increases with increasing intensity of exposure, and for many carcinogens, such as tobacco smoke, even more with increasing duration of exposure, the only way to avoid the carcinogenic risk is to avoid exposure altogether. This is why we tend to ban carcinogens from the environment. Asbestos, a particular example, why so much effort is taken to get people, particularly young people, not to smoke. But further, we now recognize that people vary in their genetic makeup, and that certain genes can make some people more susceptible to the effect of carcinogens than other people. It is those susceptible that safety codes should be designed to protect. As an epidemiologist who's done a great deal of work on breast cancer, one of the most concerning factors that has come to light are a series of case reports, starting with some reports from California and recently with the identification of a similar case in Saskatchewan. There are now 7 case reports in all, of women who have developed unusual breast cancers in the exact position where they kept cell phones in their bras. And these are unusual tumours. They are multifocal, it means they occur in several places. They seem to mirror where the cell phone was being kept. So the radiation from the cell phone seems to have increased in these women the risk, which they presumably already had, the risk of developing breast cancer. They were all relatively young women. It is a most unusual occurrence which must concern us greatly. So we have brain cancers, parotid gland tumours, which are tumours of the salivary gland, the parotid gland here, and there have been several instances of people who developed this. And in Israel recently, a study identified increasing risk of these cancers, particularly with increasing exposure. Given the long history, natural history of cancer, and the fact that human populations have not been exposed for a sufficient length of time to exclude a carcinogenic effect, it is, in my view, extremely important to adopt a precautionary approach to the exposure of humans to radiofrequency fields, particularly children. We should note that an individual, if appropriately informed, can reduce their exposure to radiofrequency fields from devices that use Wi-Fi, but in the case of cell towers and smart meters, the exposure they receive is outside their control. And then with the people who manufacture these devices and those who promote Wi-Fi in all sorts of instances, we're reaching a situation that homes are being saturated with radio frequency fields. Now, it's going to be very difficult to prove conclusively an effect, because an effect spread over a large population, if the normal occurrence is relatively rare, and it is relatively rare for brain tumours to occur, even if you double the risk or triple the risk or even quadruple the risk, it will be difficult to identify that precisely. But we need to do these studies, and in the meantime, to avoid a potential epidemic of cancer caused by radio frequency fields from Wi-Fi and other devices, we should strengthen the codes which are meant to protect the public. In my view, Health Canada has not done an adequate job, and that the current Safety Code 6 in its present iteration needs to be re-revised. I thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Next up is Mr. Frank Clegg. Go ahead, sir.
Am I on?
Yep.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair and committee members, I'd like to thank you for the invitation to speak with you this afternoon and for deciding to invest committee time on Safety Code 6. When I ran the Canadian operations for Microsoft, I learned it is critical to focus on process. Today, as a board member for Indigo Books and Music, my role has shifted more towards governance and oversight. In both roles, process is critical to success. Government is the largest corporation of all, so process is of paramount importance. As someone who regularly examines success and failure, I believe I can explain why the Safety Code 6 process is a failure by all metrics and has left Canadians unprotected. There is a book written by Nassim Taleb called The Black Swan, a focus on very low probability, high impact events that aren't supposed to happen. Oil spills, train derailments, and airplane crashes are some of the events in this category. Taleb calls these black swan events. If one decides all swans are white and refuses evidence of black swans, then one will conclude all swans are white. Black swans are rare, but they do exist. Unfortunately, experts convinced themselves these events had zero probability and did not plan appropriately, and people died. The American Academy of Environmental Medicine is an international organization of physicians and scientists that has predicted, among other things, the rise in multiple chemical sensitivity, which is now protected in many public policies. Regarding the unprecedented increase in wireless devices, the Academy forecasts, and I quote, a widespread public health hazard that the medical system is not yet prepared to address. I believe that Health Canada's analysis focuses on identifying and counting white swans while ignoring black swan evidence. Health Canada's representative informed this committee on March 24th, and I quote, some of these studies report biological or adverse health effects of RF fields at levels below the limits of Safety Code 6. I want to emphasize that these studies are in the minority and they do not represent the prevailing line of scientific evidence in this area. In other words, black swans exist. In your handout, or I don't know if you have it, we put in for translation, is a document entitled an analysis of 140 studies submitted by C4ST during the public comment period on Safety Code 6. There is a chart in that document that shows Health Canada accepts that there are, in fact, 36 studies, all passing Health Canada's quality criteria, showing harm at levels below Safety Code 6. As a Canadian, I find this confusing. As an executive, I find it inexcusable. Of the 36 studies Health Canada deemed satisfactory, cancer is linked in 6 of them. In 13 of them, the brain and or nervous system is disrupted. In 16 studies, Health Canada admits that biochemical disruption occurs. And finally, 7 high-level scientific studies indicate an effect on intellectual development and or learning behavior. All of these studies show impacts with radiation below Safety Code 6 limits. How was this black swan evidence evaluated? In our two-year investigation, C4ST has determined that Health Canada doesn't even have the proper software required to access, summarize, and analyze the large number of relevant studies. If our group of learned and qualified volunteers can uncover 140 studies, how many more are being missed or ignored? Health Canada references its weight of evidence approach. It is unclear how many studies you need to outweigh 36 studies that show harm, especially to children. I just can't fathom why Health Canada is not highlighting these studies and prioritizing their implications. Despite requests to publish the weight of evidence criteria as per international standards, Health Canada refuses to do so. Even the recent 2015 rationale document does not provide this critical information. Health Canada dismisses scientific evidence unless it shows harm where the microwave levels are strong enough to heat your skin. The notion that microwaves are not harmful unless they heat your skin is decades out of date. The core premise of this white swan dates back to Einstein's theory that non-ionizing radiation cannot cause harm, or if it does, it must heat tissue to do that. Albert Einstein passed away the same year that Steve Jobs was born. To think that science has not evolved since then is classic white swan thinking. It's part of a process predetermined to fail. Health Canada says on its website today that there is no chance Wi-Fi or cell phones can harm you because it has studied all the science. But when pressed under oath, Health Canada officials give a more fulsome answer. In a Quebec Superior Court in September 2013, Health Canada senior scientist James McNamee admitted that Health Canada only assesses risk based on the thermal effect, i.e., the heating of tissue. Unfortunately, Canada has not invested the necessary time nor had the balanced opinion of experts necessary to undertake a proper review. Our research has uncovered that the Health Canada author of Safety Code 6 has published papers demonstrating his bias towards this topic. In a few hours, over 3 days, this health committee has spent more time speaking with scientific experts who believe there is harm from wireless radiation below Safety Code 6 than all of Health Canada combined. You can't find black swans when you don't talk to the experts who've identified them. There's a fundamental business rule: you can't manage what you don't measure. It is clear that Health Canada not only doesn't follow that rule, but even resists it. A memo obtained under access to information to the Minister of Health in March of 2012 revealed, and I quote, "Health Canada does not support the recommendation to establish an adverse reaction reporting process specifically for RF exposure." The memo goes on to state, "Consumer complaints may be directed to the web-based system under the Canada Consumer Protection Product Safety Act." This is an inadequate solution and I believe is a missed opportunity. I refer you to the C4ST fact sheet. I think you have it. I know it was in for translation. I'd like to highlight three examples from that fact sheet. Health Canada Safety Code 6 is among the countries with the worst guidelines in the world. Canada has fallen behind other countries such as France, Taiwan, and Belgium in protecting Canadians. And finally, Health Canada has wasted over $100,000 of taxpayers' money. The Royal Society report is not an independent review. Health Canada also states that Safety Code 6 is a guideline and other organizations at the provincial and local level of government are free to implement lower levels as they see fit. However, that's not the reality of what happens. We have witnessed school boards, power and water utilities, Industry Canada, and manufacturers depending on Health Canada's analysis and, frankly, abdicating to it. They don't perform their own analysis. Safer solutions exist. There are several situations in Canada regarding cell towers where the proponents have voluntarily offered to restrict radiation exposure, in some cases thousands of times less than Safety Code 6. There is a solution in Iowa for smart meters that uses a wired meter, which provides a safer, more secure solution at a lower cost. Given that our track record in North America is not successful regarding such products as tobacco, asbestos, BPA, thalidomide, DDT, urea formaldehyde insulation, and many others, Use of the precautionary principle of prudent avoidance should be recommended until the science proves beyond reasonable doubt that there is no potential for harm. For the last 3 years, science has published a new study every month that shows irreparable harm at levels below Safety Code 6. That is why we're asking the committee to take three decisive steps. First, conduct a national campaign to educate Canadians about methods to minimize exposure to RF radiation, ban Wi-Fi in daycare centers and preschools, and ban the marketing of wireless devices to children. Secondly, protect individuals who are sensitive to RF radiation by accommodating them with safer levels of wireless exposure in federal workplaces and federal areas of responsibility. And finally, third, create an adverse reporting system for Canadians and a publicly available database to collect improved data regarding potential links between health effects and exposure to RF radiation. Parallel to the above, recommend that Health Canada conduct a comprehensive, systematic review subject to international standards regarding the potential harmfulness of RF radiation to human health with a scientific review panel that is balanced in opinion. It was a textbook case of black swan thinking that has led to this failure of Safety Code 6. So in conclusion, C4ST volunteers found 36 black swans that Health Canada agrees are high quality. How many are available if Health Canada sincerely looked? Better yet, how many black swans will it take before Health Canada takes serious actions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Next up, we have Professor Havas, and you have a presentation?
I do. It will come partway through my talk.
Okay, great.
Thank you very much for the invitation to address you today. My name is Dr. Magda Havas, and I'm Associate Professor of Environmental and Resource Studies at Trent University in Peterborough, Ontario. For the past 25 years, I have been teaching university students about the biological effects of electromagnetic fields and electromagnetic radiation that are collectively referred to as electrosmog. It is my belief that electrosmog is the emerging public health issue due largely but not entirely to the rapid proliferation of wireless technology. Concern among the public and healthcare practitioners is growing as chronic illness increases and healthcare costs rise. Since 2000, I have given more than 300 invited lectures at medical conferences, at universities, to congressional and Senate staff in the United States, to community groups concerned with Wi-Fi in schools and antennas in their neighborhoods. In 2002, Charles Katcha invited me to present to the Environment Committee of the House of Commons. In 2010, I appeared before the HESA Committee to discuss the very same issue we are discussing today. And in 2013, we presented to the Canadian Medical Association and the Royal College of Physicians and Surgeons about the harmful effects of electrosmog and the need for public protection. I began my career as an environmental toxicologist in the mid-1970s, and the emerging issue at that time was acid rain. I was one of the scientists who studied the damage that acid rain does to forests and lakes. My peer-reviewed published research and that of other scientists helped bring in clean air legislation, referred to as the Acid Rain Accord, signed into international law by Prime Minister Mulroney and President Bush in 1991. This accord guaranteed cleaner air and a healthier environment for millions of Canadians and Americans and protected our aquatic and terrestrial ecosystems. We need similar steps to be taken for electrosmog legislation. That accord was due to the work of the Canadian Coalition on Acid Rain, federal and provincial ministers of the environment like Charles Katcha and Jim Bradley, and a large number of scientific studies from Eastern North America and North Central Europe. The accord came 15 years after my studies began on the effects of acid rain. We were able to get clean air legislation because members of Parliament based their policy decisions on the science and not on misinformation provided by industry representatives. At that time, acid rain was not taken seriously. Industry scientists repeatedly claimed that acid rain did not exist or was natural and was not responsible for the loss of fish and the death of trees. This denial of a problem is common in health and environmental issues that have financial consequences for those generating the pollution. We have seen it with asbestos, DDT, lead, cigarettes, and now electrosmog. So today I find myself in a similar situation to that of acid rain. We have industry scientists who repeatedly claim that electromagnetic pollution does not cause cancer or adverse effects on health. These wireless industries are able to hide behind Health Canada's Safety Code 6, which affords them more protection than that of the public. Schools that have installed Wi-Fi, the telecommunication industry that installs antennas on hospitals and in residential communities, provincial and municipal governments that do not have expertise in this area all hide behind Health Canada's Safety Code 6 with the false perception that they are being protected. What they don't realize is this guideline was designed to protect military personnel from heating of tissue averaged over a six-minute period. It was not intended to protect the infant in the crib lying next to a wireless baby monitor that emits microwave radiation for 12 hours a day. The science that I teach dates back to the 1940s when U.S. Navy labs documented illness among radar equipment operators. Back then, it was called microwave illness. Today, it is called electrohypersensitivity. Radar operators were made sick by the same frequencies later used for the microwave oven, which originally was called the radar range. The same frequencies are now used in Wi-Fi devices. We wouldn't want to live near a radar installation, yet we generate radar frequencies in our home with our wireless technology. Symptoms of electrohypersensitivity include headaches, chronic pain, chronic fatigue, sleeping problems, difficulty concentrating, poor short-term memory, mood disorders including depression and anxiety, dizziness, nausea, and tinnitus. As many as 3% of the population, 1 million Canadians, have EHS symptoms that are so severe they are unable to function in our modern world. Another 35%, 10 million Canadians, have mild to moderate symptoms. These symptoms resemble aging, and so I refer to electrohypersensitivity as rapid aging syndrome. My research shows that radio frequency radiation from a cordless phone at levels well below 1% of safety code 6 causes an irregular or rapid heart rate in those who are sensitive. This is called tachycardia. In a few individuals, their heart rate increases from 60 beats per minute to 100 beats per minute while they're lying down on a bed without knowing whether the device is turned on or off. The tachycardia is often associated with anxiety, and the feeling is that they are actually experiencing a heart attack. Dr. Steven Sinatra, an American cardiologist, believes that minor heart abnormalities, one of which is called Wolff's Parkinson's White syndrome, affects 1 in 700 children. Combined with exercise and exposure to microwave radiation like Wi-Fi or nearby cell phone antennas, this creates the perfect storm that could result in cardiac arrest. The population in Ottawa, elementary schools with approximately 143,000 students, may have as many as 200 students who are at risk because of this particular heart effect if they have Wi-Fi in their school environment. In the early studies with radar operators, doctors recommended that workers be screened for heart irregularities before working with microwave radiation. Perhaps students should be screened before attending Wi-Fi-equipped schools. As part of my research, I am trying to find biomarkers for electrohypersensitivity so that doctors can be better equipped to diagnose the environmental illness. So far, we have found several: heart rate variability, blood viscosity, sugar among diabetics, and muscular coordination problems with people who are who have multiple sclerosis. More biomarkers are needed. Unlike epidemiological studies that document an association between an agent and an outcome, our studies demonstrate a cause-effect relationship. Experts who testify at hearings such as this have either general or specific backgrounds in either science or medicine. Those with a general background and no experience with their patients or through their own research are likely to provide misleading information. The reason for this is that we are going through a paradigm shift in our understanding of the relationship between electromagnetic energy and how the human body works. We now recognize that our cells and organs communicate with each other using electromagnetic impulses rather than just chemical messengers. Any signal that interferes with that communication may adversely affect the health of individuals. So the effects are a function of not only intensity, but frequency, modulation, waveform. What you see in front of you is, in the bottom slide, that is a picture of my blood under the microscope. The cells around, a few are connected, most of them are free. This looks like fairly healthy blood. After I use a computer for 50 minutes, I get the blood in the top left-hand corner. The blood cells are sticking together. 10 minutes after using a cordless phone, my blood becomes very sticky, very viscous, and it doesn't distribute the oxygen in my body the way it should. This is one of the symptoms of electrohypersensitivity. Doctors are not taught in medical schools about electrosmog, as it is a relatively recent problem, nor are they taught how to diagnose electrohypersensitivity. For them, this illness does not exist. When doctors can't identify an illness, they often assume it is psychological. I've spoken to psychiatrists who tell me that they are regularly sent patients who have physiological problems, not psychological ones. Some of these people are electrically hypersensitive. Industry scientists often refer to studies that report that subjects who claim to have EHS are unable to subjectively determine whether a device is on or off. They falsely conclude that this means that the person is not electrically hypersensitive. The flawed assumption here is that perception is not necessary for a physiological action to occur, and the reactions occur immediately. Neither are true. We can be outside on a sunny day when the sun is neither visible nor hot, still get a sunburn. We do not perceive ultraviolet radiation. The sunburn develops over time. Sensitivity to the sun varies among individuals, as does electrohypersensitivity. Indeed, sensitivity to the sun is a good analogy for EHS. The longer you expose, the more severe the sunburn. If you look at the 20 years it took for acid rain and the 50 years it took to address the tobacco, the outlook for wireless technology is bleak. That's because it's not one culprit. There are many things in our environment that generate acid rain. Smog. The bottom line is that levels of microwave radiation are currently well above background levels and continue to increase as more wireless devices are brought to market. These levels, despite being below Safety Code 6, are adversely affecting human health. We can wait another 5 years, or we can take steps in the right direction to reduce our exposure. If we err, we should err on the side of caution. I have a quick demonstration, if you give me a half a minute to do.
Do half a minute, yes.
Thank you. What I have here is a meter that measures radio frequency radiation. It's a directional meter. And what I have here also is a wireless baby monitor that's kept by the crib by the infant's crib. And what you can see is that we're picking up microwave radiation converted into sound. And this radiation actually goes for quite a distance. So infants are basically exposed all the time to this radiation. What I'd like to suggest is that we have technology in Europe that is voice-activated. That technology is not available here in Canada, and so our infants and others in the household are exposed when they don't need to be. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. That concludes our presentations. Into the questions. We're going to get the first 7 minutes of questions in French, so you'll need your earpiece. Okay. Okay. Ms. Moore, yes? Okay. Go ahead, Ms. Moore.
Premièrement, j'aimerais poser une question au professeur Miller. Selon mon expérience clinique, quand on a des cas de cancer chez des jeunes personnes, on a souvent une propagation très rapide parce que la propagation est souvent proportionnelle à la capacité du système immunitaire. Et quand on a des jeunes en santé, ils ont un très bon système immunitaire. Donc, c'est souvent des cancers fulgurants. Donc, est-ce qu'on devrait s'inquiéter particulièrement que ces cancers-là semblent frapper des jeunes, donc que ça risque d'être des cancers assez fulgurants, ou est-ce qu'on va avoir de la difficulté à intervenir comparativement à par exemple, des cancers qui se produisent plus tard en âge?
Well, I think that's indeed possible. There is, as you may know, there is a study being conducted in Canada currently, together with other countries, Australia and some European countries, which is trying to evaluate whether or not an association exists between exposure to radio frequency fields and occurrence of highly malignant brain tumors. Of course, the two examples I largely spoke to, brain tumor and breast cancer, they were related to the position of the device which was emitting radio frequency fields, i.e. the cell phone. And I think if this is now happening increasingly with children exposed, we can expect to see more cancers that could well be very difficult to treat. As you know, brain cancers are not easy to treat, and some breast cancers, like these multifocal cancers, are not easy to treat. Of the 7 cases, 2 already have metastases. So there is a potential risk of rapidly progressive and more malignant tumors. I agree.
À l'heure actuelle, au niveau du Code 6, les limites d'exposition s'adressent, si on peut dire, à une population générale, donc il n'y a aucune différenciation au niveau des populations à risque. Est-ce qu'à l'avis des trois témoins, il devrait avoir des évaluations spécifiques des règles, des limites pour les populations à risque, comme par exemple les enfants, les femmes enceintes et les personnes qui sont immunosupprimées?
I do indeed. I think there should be much greater caution in relation to exposure to children because of what we've already discussed, the fact their cells are developing much more quickly. Devices such as that which Dr. Havas has demonstrated, I think, should be banned.
May I add a comment? What we asked or suggesting as one of the recommendations is we think there's a lead that the federal government can play in identifying federal regulated buildings and federal properties and say that, you know, make those leading in Canada to protect individuals who are electrosensitive and children and pregnant women. So I think there's an opportunity for the federal government to take the lead, and we hope and believe that if the feds take the lead, then other municipalities and provinces will follow as well, and focusing on electrosensitive, pregnant women, and definitely children.
Could I add something to that as well?
Yeah, for sure.
We have precedent setting when it comes to water quality. The nitrogen levels in drinking water are actually based on protecting infants. They're not based on protecting adults. So I think that's what the Safety Code 6 guidelines should be based on, protecting the most sensitive people within our population.
Vous avez parlé, M. Miller, des tumeurs associées, par exemple, du même côté où est-ce qu'on porte le téléphone, au niveau des femmes, il y avait des cancers du sein au même endroit où les femmes portaient leur téléphone dans leur soutien-gorge. Est-ce que il y a des études ou est-ce qu'on a noté des problèmes au niveau... Bon, il y a plusieurs hommes qui portent leur téléphone dans leur poche de pantalon. Donc, est-ce qu'il y a eu des impacts au niveau cancer testiculaire ou au niveau de la fertilité masculine qui ont été démontrés dans des études?
Particularly fertility problems, they have been identified. I believe a witness next week will expand upon this. I'm not yet aware of any studies relating testicular cancer, but that may happen. I don't know.
There is evidence of testicular cancer among police officers that had radar guns using radar to detect speeding. They very seldom turned the gun off. They just kept it on their lap. And they do have an increase of testicular cancer. And radar is microwave radiation.
On sait que les problèmes d'infertilité coûtent de plus en plus cher au niveau des services de santé, au niveau des provinces. Donc, selon vous, on devrait porter une attention particulière à ça si on ne veut pas se retrouver, si on peut dire, avec une facture plus tard, parce que souvent, on essaie longtemps avant d'avoir un enfant, avant de se rendre compte que c'est ça, et souvent, si ça fait déjà 20 ans qu'on a le téléphone cellulaire dans nos poches, ça devient difficile d'agir par la suite, donc ça devrait être une préoccupation particulière à votre avis?
Again, one of our recommendations is for Health Canada to raise an awareness campaign, and a part of that awareness campaign should be telling people to keep young men to keep the phone out of their pants pocket, and because that's where men keep their phone. Young men keep their phone in their pocket, so that's why we're calling for a recommendation to have Health Canada educate people to say, be aware that there is a potential risk, and prevent.
We have evidence that it affects sperm, and so what Frank Clegg is saying is correct. However, we don't know how it affects egg cells. We know that sperm are reproduced regularly. After 3 months, you have fresh sperm. So one of the recommendations is for people who are trying to get pregnant to not have the male use a cell phone for at least 3 months, or at least not keep it in a pocket. However, women are born with all of their egg cells, and so if our egg cells are damaged, this could have very long-lasting effects on the population.
Thank you very much. Next up, Mr. Wilkes. Go ahead, sir.
Thanks, Chair. Thank the witnesses for being here, and I'll share my time with Mr. Richards because he has to leave here after the first hour, I believe. So, you perked my interest when you said police officers and radar, because I went, hey, I did that for a year and a half. So, but... one thing I did want, Professor Miller, you mentioned in your opening remarks, an opportunity to provide greater safety to the public has been missed. And you did explain a bit about it, but I wonder if you could articulate a little more on what we've missed and what we could move forward with respect to recommendations to Health Canada and to the Minister.
Well, I think what Health Canada, I'm not saying this committee has missed, but what Health Canada has missed is a proper scientific review of the data that would, in fact, convince them, and I don't understand why they haven't been convinced, that the limits they have placed in their advisory limits are not sufficiently safe to protect the population. And that's why I believe that an opportunity to protect the population and potentially to prevent a major cancer problem in the future has been missed by Health Canada.
And Dr. Miller, you had talked about different, and all three of you talked about different types of cancer. The one that interested me most is the one around the ear, and that, because it seems to me as that would be one of the more difficult ones to deal with. If you attract cancer in that area. I wonder if either or three of you could speak to that and the difficulties that may arise. And one last thing, and then I'll turn it over to my colleague, Mr. Richards. I noticed I have four grandkids, and they have these things. And what they do is they put them on their lap to play, because that's the most convenient way to do that. What would your suggestion be to educating Canadians with regards to their young children playing with their laptops on their lap or iPads, because it's just convenient? They don't think any other way. Is there something that we should be encouraging them to put between where they're placing the iPad and the iPad itself? Whoever wants to answer that, and then Mr. Richards.
If it comes for the last question that you asked about the iPad, if they have the iPad in airplane mode, then there's not a problem. They're not being irradiated. However, there is now a device that you can connect to your iPad and hook it up through Ethernet. So as long as you have Ethernet in your home, you can actually use the iPad. There's information on the web online that you can get your... We did it with my grandson, and he's now as happy as a dumpling because we allow him to use his iPad, but it's not wireless. We have it in a wired way.
In relation to your first question... One of the things which has been clearly identified is that the brain cancers, the gliomas, the malignant brain cancers, are occurring in the position in the brain where physics demonstrates where the radiation from the cell phone placed at the ear actually focuses. I think it's extremely clear and it's been very well documented.
Thank you very much, Mr. Rich.
Thank you. How much time do I have? Okay, great. I've got a couple of questions, so hopefully I'll have time for both. Start with you, Dr. Havas. You mentioned in response to one of the other questions and also in your opening remarks about a couple of things that people could do to try to, sort of decrease their exposure, to some of the electromagnetic radiation. But I'm kind of curious, as many of us, it's sort of almost a part of our day-to-day lives to have to utilize, this kind of technology or this kind of technology. I'm aware that obviously, turning it off when you're not absolutely needing to have the transmit, I'm not sure if I got the right technical terms, but the transmitting taking place. And I would assume that obviously when you're actually using the phone that it's exposing you to higher levels of radiation. So when you're carrying it and it's not being in use, that's helpful. But can you maybe give us some sense as to what are some of the things that Canadians could be doing to try to limit their exposures or things they could be doing to better protect themselves from any effects?
Probably the three worst culprits in the home are the wireless baby monitor, the cordless phone, and the Wi-Fi, because they're on all the time, whether you're using them or not. With the phone, you can have it wired. You can still buy wired phones. You would have to have multiple ones. When it comes to the baby monitors and the cordless phones, in Europe, the baby monitors are voice-activated, which means there's no radiation until the baby cries. We've been trying to get these phones into Canada. We haven't been successful so far. Also in Europe, the cordless phones that you have there do not radiate until you actually use them. We had them here in Canada. They were banned by the FCC, and Canada simply followed suit. It's almost impossible to get them unless you go to Europe and buy them. When it comes to Wi-Fi, you can simply connect the Ethernet connection. There's also something called a home plug, which means that you can put the information onto the electrical wires in your home and use your computer and at any outlet, so you can still get internet access anywhere in your home without having microwave radiation.
Can I add one comment too? What we recommend a lot of people is to sometimes you can't run the wires, is go to Canadian Tire and buy a timer that you put your Christmas lights on, your holiday lights, and so enforce it while your children are sleeping, your body's in a state of repair and growth. So just as you said, distance is your friend. So I have a book that I carry that has a little insert in it, and I put my phone in there, and guys don't usually carry books against themselves. So there's just be aware that distance is your friend, and think about it at all time, and anything that's wireless in your house, what can you do either to eliminate it or reduce the amount of time that it's turned on?
Those are excellent suggestions. Thank you very much, and I hope I have just a little bit of time.
About 30 seconds.
Okay, I'll try and be very quick. My understanding is Industry Canada had taken Mr. Higg some steps to try and better enforce safety guidelines with new cell phone towers that are being constructed. Do you know much about that, and could you tell us?
We're very aware, and we're involved with part of that. The guidelines, what Industry Canada did, and it was a good step forward, was to provide more notification. But all that does is it just provides more notification for communities when there's a cell tower and antenna being put into the community. But they default to Health Canada for anything to do with the levels of radiation that come from it.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. Fry, go ahead.
Thank you very much. And again, I am... it's just like deja vu. I think you asked a very important question, Dr. Havas, and that is... I don't understand. It inherent in, for instance, a medical ethos, it's first do no harm. So the primary thing for a physician is a precautionary principle. Unless you see that the benefits outweigh the risks, then you are prepared to do some harm in order to divert worse harm. But I think what bothers me, and I don't know, so maybe you have an answer for me. I've been listening to these, and so I called up my son and daughter-in-law, and I said, hey, you guys got a wireless baby monitor on my granddaughter's crib. So here I'm hearing this stuff, and I think maybe you should just take precautions and just, you know, get a plug-in or find a way to turn it on only when you need to. And I said, and they all said to me, oh, for God's sake, that is such a bunch of hokey stuff. You know, I mean, the guidelines are clear, blah, blah, blah. And, of course, I was almost accused of being some sort of crying wolf kind of human being. And so, you know, I don't know if I couldn't convince my children that this is not reasonable and fair. And I think you said 50 years before we got anybody to understand, in spite of evidence, that cigarettes caused cancer. Acid rain, 20 years. Surely to goodness, we need to have learned by now that we shouldn't be taking that length of time. We need to have been able to look at the evidence of not acting on evidence sooner and the harm that it does. How do you think, however, given that the biggest people that are blocking this are industry themselves, and of course governments, let's be honest, have to balance economic growth and development and progress against harm to the greater good kind of thing, that there is this almost conflict of interest in how governments can or do currently operate and how governments could operate in terms of protecting people. What are ways in which one could convince the public, however, who are completely addicted to Wi-Fi and to wireless devices because they don't know anything else? I mean, I'm addicted. I can't put away my stupid BlackBerry. So, I mean, I think, how do we convince? Because public awareness, obviously, as you said, Frank, that must be a part of the recommendations. How do you put forward a public awareness program that will actually reach and sink in without people saying, oh, my God, everybody is being so hysterical about this?
I would make two comments, Dr. Fry. I would say that people are smart, and when they have the right information, they act appropriately and they act responsibly, particularly parents with newborns. What I've heard, though, hundreds of times now, it must be okay if Health Canada says it's safe. And they don't understand that it takes time for this information to be digested. And as Dr. Miller had said, we are befuddled on why Health Canada isn't being more active. So I think if there was the health authority in Canada, which is called Health Canada, came out with very clear statements that says there is proof that there could be harm, be careful and take a precautionary approach, I think you would see the majority of Canadians change what they do. The other comment when you make about industry, I've spent my life in industry. And what we do is we go out and we work hard to provide better technology, cheaper, faster, better. That's the way we work, right? But we also react when you challenge us. And we're not challenging industry right now. I think if you challenge my industry to come up with more effective ways to do it, as I said, we have seen situations where cell towers are going into communities where they're thousands of times less than Safety Code 6 because the community has made a fuss. So we know the industry can do it. So the industry has demonstrated. We have technology in Europe. The industry is not jamming or trying to go through the process to get it into Canada because they don't need to. So the industry will respond, it will react, it will act responsibly if we set the challenge in front of it. And I think we're missing that opportunity to go to the industry and to lower the standards on Safety Code 6, and then industry will react to it and provide better products. I mentioned the state of Iowa, full smart meter functionality, and their wired meters. Right, that state chose to do it. If you went to the technology industry and said there's, you know, we are no longer allowed to sell tablet devices in schools that are wireless, you would have immediately many solutions that would be wired. So challenge. I'm asking the committee to challenge my industry to do a better job.
Yes, I do think, however, there's this inherent conflict and problem because Industry Canada should be looking at how we make sure that industry is progressive and is functioning and we have economic development going on in the country. But that is not Health Canada's mandate.
No, it's not.
Health Canada's mandate is very clear.
Yeah.
It is supposed to protect the health and safety
Agreed.
Of Canadians.
Agreed.
Now, surely to goodness, I think we in this committee here, having heard the things we heard and having learned, because I'm long in the tooth, of the things that we had been fighting for such a long time that caused great harm, and eventually everyone is now seat belts, legislation, all of that kind of thing that protected people. But it was a long fight. And I think, for me, you know, the idea that we should let Health Canada believe that it has to be true to its own mandate, which is protection of Canadians, should be the overriding concern of this committee. And I can tell you now it's something that I've taken seriously. It's something I'm going to do something about, because I've lived through this stuff having as a physician and all of the years as an environmental advocate, et cetera, that we have to do better than we currently do now. So I want to thank you for your presentation, actually, because it's clear, it's scientifically based, and you know, the evidence that you talked about is something that we need to call for another review, a new review. And given that other countries have set the tone, France and Israel and other countries, I think that this committee should hear you very clearly. I know some of us are.
May I give you some advice about your grandchild? There is a material you can buy that has silver in it that you can place over the crib. And so the Wi-Fi, the wireless baby monitor will still work, but the infant will be protected. And there are companies in Canada that sell these products. So you can still, you know, protect the infant.
So that can be a little gift from Grandma.
That would be a lovely gift from Grandma. Yeah.
My only comment would be that that's interim, though.
Yeah. Yes.
Grandmother, we want you to change safety concepts.
Yeah.
Right.
That's my other hat, right?
Okay, yeah, that's fair. We have both hats in mind.
Up next, Ms. McLeod, go ahead.
Thank you, and I'd like to thank the witnesses for their presentations. You know, certainly I have mentioned before I was on the committee that originally set that process in place in terms of the work done by the Royal Society. So, you know, certainly the intention of the committee was to have something that was very solid in terms of its response to that issue. Now, I understand Canada's also currently very active with the WHO in terms of sort of a massive undertaking, and is maybe that the better place to be really looking at the scientific reviews around this issue? Could someone speak to the WHO process? And because it seems sometimes like we have all these different countries who spend a lot of time, money, energy, and keep reinventing the wheel. So what about this international collaboration piece, and is that the better mechanism?
We would like to believe it was. But unfortunately, the information coming out in the form of drafts for comment have suggested that the WHO process has been as conflicted and as behind the scenes as the Royal Society panel in Canada. And it's unclear where the problems are arising from, but there do appear to have been substantial industry links of some of the people who were in the WHO division before. And so, although we would hope things would improve, at the moment I am not confident that it will happen.
I would also add, I think, Ms. McLeod, as a Canadian, I am proud that we're leading the world on some things like acid rain, and I don't want to wait for an international consensus to act. I would be afraid to death that my future grandchildren would have to wait for the WHO to lead what I think is clear evidence today that Health Canada has the mandate, has the authority, has the resources to lead the world or be among the leaders. In fact, not even lead the world, catch up to some countries. So I would really resist relying on a WHO process. When they did the IR committee, and you'll hear from the next speaker that the IR committee, which Dr. Miller wrote the paper on the cancer section, you had a full body of scientists who had contrarian opinion. And that is what I learned over the last several years now, is where good science happens, is you have two sides of the debate, and they get in a room, as they did in 2011, and they debated among 30 scientists around the world. The WHO committee is not made up of a balance of scientists with opposing views.
So I really appreciate, and of course you can imagine, we need to listen to the people that are saying black swan, but we also, you know, if there's consensus within the scientists, it becomes a bit of a challenge for some of us to sort of weed our way through the different processes. A quick question, Dr. Havas, why was that phone banned? And why is the baby monitor not in? Just
the reason the federal communication gave was that it interfered with military frequencies, which is nonsense.
Good. And my next question, Dr. Miller, you talked about case studies, as we all know, can be that black swan that starts to alert us. But then obviously we need some sort of processes after that. So can you talk about those, and maybe I dismissed it in your presentation, have we gone obviously significant past case studies to actual epidemiological data that's showing dramatic increases that have happened over time? So,
well, a number of us are working on this. I mean, there is now evidence that in the United States there have been increases in the cancers which are associated, the brain cancers associated with cell phone use. People have said that hasn't happened, but in fact it has been happened. I'm collaborating with Dr. Davis, who's coming here next week, on a paper that will document this further. There is also a large international collaboration ongoing now of studies identifying large numbers of people whose exposure will be documented, and then they will be followed for several years to find out whether or not their exposure to radio frequency field has increased their risk of cancer. But this is a very long-term endeavor. It will probably take a decade or more to get information of that sort. So there is a lot of activity. There isn't very much, I'm afraid, in this country, except for the Moby Kids study. I believe people are increasingly recognizing the need to collect the necessary data to provide us with the information we require.
And is the, you were calling it the EHS or EFS?
EHS, electrohypersensitivity.
Now, is that actually a recognized diagnosis now?
It's recognized by the Austrian Medical Association. They put out a document recently trying to alert doctors on it and how to identify it. The World Health Organization in 2004 held a conference on electrical hypersensitivity. That's what they called it. But they decided that a better name for it would be idiopathic environmental illness. And idiopathic means we don't have a clue as to what's causing it, which meant that they didn't have to do anything about it. There was a lot of debate at that, a lot of disagreement among the scientists, because that just means you don't have to deal with the problem because you assume you don't understand what it is. So it's recognized in parts of Europe. It's recognized by certain associations within the United States. American Association for Environmental Medicine is one of the groups that recognizes electrohypersensitivity along with multiple chemical sensitivity.
I would add, too, that the Canadian Human Rights Commission does recognize electrohypersensitivity as well. And if somebody is diagnosed in the workplace, they actually have the ability to go through the process and get support and compensation.
So is there any sort of indication of what percentage of the population might struggle with this?
I think probably between 1 and 3% have severe electrohypersensitivity, so they're quite, it's very difficult for them to survive in our type of world. And many of them have to move into the country and they can't use computers. Probably another 35% have mild to moderate symptoms, which means they come home after a day of work, they've got headaches, they feel awful, they can't sleep, but they can still trudge on. The Women's College Hospital in Toronto actually diagnoses people with electrical hypersensitivity. So we have diagnostic capabilities here in Canada.
Okay. Thanks very much. That's going to conclude the first panel here. We're going to thank the guests for appearing. We're going to suspend for 2 minutes, and we're going to bring online our video conference guests. And so we'll suspend. Thank you. Lezhinsky is from Finland, and so they're quite late in the evening right now, so I appreciate his time and consideration for this. So I'll just call for a little bit of order at the back, please, if we can. I was an auctioneer as a child growing up in my dad's business, so I do know how to call a room to order if I have to. Thank you. So first off, we're going to get Professor Lezhinsky to start his presentation, and then Professor Tarswell, you'll follow up after. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me and inviting me to this hearing. It's an honor and a pleasure. My name is Dariusz Lezhinsky, and I'm currently adjunct professor of biochemistry at the University of Helsinki in Finland. I do research in area of biological and health effects of cell phone emitted radiations since 1997. I was member of the expert group of IARC that in 2011 classified cell phone radiation as possible human carcinogen. When scientific evidence is unclear, contradictory or ambivalent, careful and unbiased interpretation of it is of paramount importance. However, it is often the case such scientific evidence gives a room for a diverse interpretation that may lead to development of contradictory expert opinions, causing confusion, impairing development of rational recommendations aimed at protecting the general population. This is the current situation in the area of cell phone and wireless communication emitted radiation. Unclear experimental evidence led to polarization of the scientific opinions into two extremes, no effect opinion and harmful effect opinion. Currently, scientists do not agree in the matter of biological and health effects of radiation exposures. The term consensus might be misleading for the general public. We should rather speak about differences in scientific opinion. Recent comment by the head of World Health Organization's EMF project, Dr. Emily van de Venter, well describes the current situation, and I quote her comment given for the Daily Princetonian. There is no consensus, it's true. There is a big group and a little group, but it's still two groups. Talk about a big and a small group is a pure speculation, because the size of the groups was never examined. From my nearly 19 years experience in this area of research, I know that the vast majority of the scientists do not take openly a side in the debate. Interpretation of scientific evidence by the committees is of most use for the decision makers. This is the reason why development of unbiased opinions by committees are of paramount importance. Opinions of committees are defined by the expert composition. In ideal committee, experts would not have conflict of interest issues and would be independent of any kind of lobbying, and only science would matter. Nearly all the committees dealing with health effects of radiation emitted by wireless communication devices have a problem of biased expert selection, potential conflict of interest, and potential influence by an industrial lobby, which may occur in spite of set up firewalls. The majority of the committees consists of scientists having the same expert opinion. Individual committees' experts commonly do not reflect all current scientific opinions. This concerns both international committees and national committees. This includes the committee in Canada that provided evidence for Safety Code 6. The composition of the Health Canada Expert Committee was clearly biased towards the no-effect opinion, and some of the experts are known to advise the telecom industry. This is a serious potential conflict of interest. The above-mentioned system of firewalls to protect experts from influence of industry does not work. Industry sponsors know who receives funding, sponsored scientists know who provides funding. This is especially worrisome when the influential ICNIRP committee is in part funded by the industry through firewall of the Royal Adelaide Hospital in Australia, and the same goes for EMF project of WHO. ICNIRP experts know very well that the opinions of ICNIRP will, if the opinions of ICNIRP will be unfavorable for the telecom industry, the sponsorship may end. The firewall is only a gimmick. Currently, WHO EMF project is preparing evaluation of the scientific evidence concerning health effects of radiation emitted by the wireless communication devices, the so-called environmental health criteria for RF-EMF. The major problem with the draft document of environmental health criteria is the lack of balanced presentation of the scientific evidence. Environmental health criteria draft was written solely by scientists with no effect opinion. Environmental health criteria document will have a global impact on billions of users of wireless technology and on the multi-trillion dollar business. This is why it is very disturbing that preparation of such a document is solely reflecting opinions of ICNIRP, an organization with firm, single-sided, no-effect opinion. This is a very disturbing situation where one group of scientists is given preferential treatment only because of their close link with the WHO, and where other relevant expert opinions are deliberately and arbitrarily excluded without scientific debate. Recommendations for decision makers developed by committees where memberships are consistently biased towards either no effect opinion or harmful effect opinion are not representative of the whole currently available scientific evidence and should be viewed with extreme caution or outright dismissed until the proper unbiased evaluation takes place. To my knowledge, there was only one scientific committee, IARC Working Experts Group, in 2011, of which I was a member, where the full scope of diverse scientific opinions was represented. IARC classification completely disagreed with one-sided opinions of the majority of international and national committees, including Health Canada. Until an unbiased, round-table scientific debate takes place, where all scientific opinions will be duly represented and evaluated, the opinions developed to date by various international and national committees based on biased expert selections should be dismissed by decision makers as insufficient. According to the document of the European Union from year 2000 on precautionary principle, There are three criteria that need to be fulfilled in order to implement precautionary principle, and all of them are currently fulfilled. Number one, scientific information is insufficient, inconclusive, or uncertain to make firm decision. This is exactly what says IARC classification of cell phone radiation as possible human carcinogen group 2B. Number two, there are indications that the possible effects of human health may be potentially dangerous. Increased risk of brain cancer in long-term avid users is a dangerous outcome, shown by the three replicates of epidemiological studies, European Interphone, Swedish Hardell Group, and French Serenard study. Effects are inconsistent with the chosen level of protection. Epidemiological studies showing increased risk in long-term avid users were generated in populations using regular cell phones, meeting all current safety standards. This means that the current safety standards are insufficient to protect users because risk of developing cancer increases in long-term avid users. Opponents of the precautionary principle need to understand that precaution does not equal prevention of use of wireless technology. Requirements to develop more efficient, less radiation-emitting technology and further biomedical research on radiation effects will create new knowledge through research and will create jobs in research and technology. Implementation of the precautionary principle will not prevent technological developments. Claims by some that the implementation of the precautionary principle will cause economic stagnation are unfounded. In the current situation of inadequate review of scientific evidence by groups of scientists with biased selection of members, and until the roundtable unbiased review is performed, decision makers should implement the precautionary principle. The reason is not because the harm was proven beyond doubt, but because the harm is possible and evidence is uncertain and suggesting that harmful health effects are possible. The precautionary principle was developed just for such situations where scientific uncertainty with concomitant indications of possible harm requires society to wait for more scientific evidence. Saying better to be safe than sorry applies here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next up, Professor Tarswell. Go ahead, sir.
Good afternoon and good evening in Finland. Thanks very much for inviting me to appear before this committee. I think it's an ongoing and imperative role of the state to assess risks to society and take appropriate mitigation where necessary. So the issue before the committee today is the risk of cell phone radiation, and for simplifying purposes, I'll assume we're meaning radiation in approximately the 1 gigahertz to 3 gigahertz range. My own background, I am competent in and a practitioner of nuclear medicine. I also am a psychiatrist. I have an interest both in the human radiobiological effects of ionizing and non-ionizing radiation and an interest in the psychological factors that are relate to medically unexplained symptoms or medical appearing presentations of in situations where there's no evidence of organic pathology, but perhaps psychopathology. I would like to just I provided some documents to the committee. I don't know if those were received in time and distributed. The first document I want to make reference to is the preamble from the International Agency for Research on Cancer, which outlines how its findings should be interpreted. And first of all,
Professor, I should just let you know, Professor, that they were submitted and they're in translation right now at this point in time.
Oh.
So,
okay.
The members of Parliament here won't have the documents in front of them, so you'll have to be very descriptive if you're referring to anything specifically. Okay.
Very good. I'll pull direct quotes then in that instance. So the IARC working group. This would be the first document that you'd be looking at. This is the single-page summary of evidence leading to the 2B conclusion in 2013 based on the 2011 meetings. And 2B means possibly carcinogenic to humans. And what the IARC means by that, and I quote directly from their preamble, this category is used for agents for which there is limited evidence of carcinogenicity in humans and less than sufficient evidence of carcinogenicity in experimental animals. It may also be used when there is inadequate evidence of carcinogenicity in humans, but there is sufficient evidence of carcinogenicity in experimental animals. And the document itself makes reference to a number of different studies which are broken down into occupational, environmental, and personal exposures. And the studies which the committee thought presented the strongest evidence were specifically the case control studies that have been referred to. Interphone has been mentioned. The Swedish studies have also been mentioned. Now, it's important to understand what a case control study is. As has been pointed out, the real way to find out if something is a health risk is prospectively to look over time at individuals who are experiencing the exposure and documenting rates of conversion to disease in the exposed versus the non-exposed, and then seeing if there's a dose-response relationship. In other words, do individuals with higher levels of exposure to a risk convert to disease at higher rates? This sort of information is, as far as I'm aware, not available in human populations for RFEMF, so we do the best we can with case control studies. Both the Interphone and the Swedish studies relied on interviewing individuals with glioma, with acoustic neuroma, and then interviewing random controls. So what they found was that in individuals with these neoplasms or cancers was that the individuals report higher levels of exposure than controls. So the question of recall bias is really important in a study like this, because we're relying on indirect lines of evidence to conclude what the exposures might have been. These folks weren't carrying detectors on them for years and years. These are telephone interviews, questionnaires. And the important thing, which IARC, to its credit, acknowledges, is the potential for what's called recall bias. In other words, if you had a catastrophic health outcome, you will naturally search for causal evidence for that outcome. And if a well-funded scientific committee wants to talk to you, then the implicit suggestion may be, well, we think there might be a link here. And so anxiety rises, and it's not very difficult to imagine how individuals with a glioma might report that, why, yes, I believe I did have higher exposure to radio frequencies. Now, the IARC also concluded that although this was a significant bias, they couldn't completely rule these studies out on the basis of bias. And what they concluded, therefore, is that there's limited evidence of carcinogenicity, meaning the quality of the evidence, is limited. Now, I want to point out, what does a 2B mean? Well, the IARC, again, in its preamble on page 23, says, this category is used for agents for which there's limited evidence of carcinogenicity in humans and less than sufficient evidence of carcinogenicity in experimental animals. Wait, I've got myself a little bit backwards. I've already read that part. I want to talk about what IARC means by limited evidence, where the data suggest a carcinogenic effect but are limited for making a definitive evaluation because, and I think in this case, clause B is the most important. There are unresolved questions regarding the adequacy of the design, conduct, or interpretation of the studies. But of course, this is an important signal within the literature, and it's one that needs to be pursued. And indeed, it has been pursued. In the just published 2015 text, Current Understanding and Treatment of Gliomas, which is available from Springer, the medical publisher, it contains a book chapter titled The Epidemiology of Gliomas. In other words, what are the causes and what are the distribution of this disease? On page 11, they quote, the scientific evidence used to produce the 2011 IARC report, as well as the scientific evidence reported since its publication, does not support a significant association between use of cellular phones and risk of glioma. They go on to say, this exposure warrants continued monitoring and examination as the potential risks of long-term heavy use, risk of use during childhood and adolescence, and the length of glioma latency is not well understood. But the studies so far, in fact, would suggest against an association, and even in 2011, the strongest association that could be found was actually very weak. Now, just to put some context, because I think C-648, which in its own preamble specifically mentions the 2B classification, is as relevant. There are currently 287 agents within category 2B, and because essentially if you cannot definitively exclude a risk, then you have to consider that it's possible. So on the list of 287 agents, I'll give you some examples of what do appear as possible carcinogenic agents. Whole leaf extract of aloe vera, carpentry and joinery as an occupation, coconut oil, coffee, ginkgo biloba extract, kava extract, pickled vegetables, and talc body powder used perineally, in other words, baby powder. Because the problem in science of proving a negative is a very difficult one. I can't prove to you that Santa is not real, because I'm not at the hearth of every single home on Christmas Eve. So from a purely scientific epidemiological point of view, I must concede it is possible that Santa Claus exists. But from the fact that I scientifically have to concede that possibility, it would be problematic to conclude, there's scientific evidence that Santa possibly exists. No, what there is evidence. There's no sufficient evidence to completely refute it. So that, epidemiologically speaking, is how these studies are meant to be interpreted. And, of course, since, as the previous witness points out, the outcome is catastrophic, ongoing study is warranted, and the studies to date, based on the latest and greatest evidence from glioma researchers and treaters, suggest that there is there's no significant association. And as I said in my appearance before the Royal Society, I think Safety Code 6 is currently an adequate and satisfactory standard. I don't believe it needs to be changed. I believe if the committee wants to apply labels to RF emitting devices on the basis of a 2B classification, then the door is opened to the labeling of all 287 agents on the basis of their 2B classification. And I don't know if that's territory into which the state wants to intrude to such a significant degree.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Ms. Moore, you're up first. Ms. Moore will be asking her questions in French, so if you're going to get your feed in English, so if you hear coming across in French, just wave and she'll stop and we'll get it fixed.
Okay. Donc mes questions vont beaucoup s'adresser au professeur Leschinski. J'aimerais, vous avez parlé beaucoup, des problèmes qu'il y a au niveau des scientifiques, au niveau des conflits d'intérêts qui quelquefois peuvent avoir eu lieu du fait que ça devient compliqué d'avoir un consensus scientifique, mais que quand même, dans les circonstances, on devrait appliquer un certain principe de précaution. Je m'interroge beaucoup au niveau des populations qui seraient particulièrement vulnérables, donc les femmes enceintes, les jeunes enfants, les personnes âgées et les personnes immunosupprimées. Et est-ce que, à votre avis, il y aurait des mesures que vous suggéreriez ou qu'on devrait prendre en appliquant ce principe de précaution pour ces populations vulnérables immédiatement, afin de limiter, si on peut dire, les risques potentiels qui peut-être, même si plus tard, s'avéraient qu'ils n'étaient pas là, mais que par principe de précaution, on devrait quand même prendre ces mesures.
When we, and it was earlier said, when we began to smoke tobacco, we waited 50 years to find out that it has some detrimental health effects. The same was, for example, for Hiroshima nuclear bomb. This, that people got more cancer, we were waiting several tens of years after this ionizing radiation exposure. Therefore, it is very problematic to say what we should do if later appears that it was an unnecessary step. So should we protect ourselves when we are uncertain, or should we wait for next 40, 50 years for some sort of more definitive evidence and answer? But then we are facing another problem. What if indeed those epidemiological studies indicating that if somebody is using cell phone avidly, and by avid use was considered then using cell phone for 10 years every day for half an hour per day. And it was a long time ago, 10, 15 years ago, when cell phones and using them, that was expensive and people were not using so much. Nowadays, with 3 minutes from operators, people are using much more cell phones than before. And we have already in 2011 those two sets of studies, Interphone and studies from Sweden, were considered by the 30 scientists, and 26 of them voted for this, that there is enough scientific evidence to say that this is possible human carcinogen. We had two studies. Now, in 2014, last year, was another study published, same type of study from France, done in different population, arriving at exactly the same result. If person is using for 10 years or more, avidly half an hour per day or more, then risk of getting brain cancer is increasing. And very many people say, as it was right now mentioned about what glioma scientists are thinking about, connection between cell phone radiation and glioma. It is not exactly so, because they say, right now we don't have evidence, but we have to remember two things. First of all, cell phones are in common avid use for not very many years, maybe 10 years, maybe 15. They are longer used in Scandinavia, but those beginnings were such that people were using very little of those cell phones. That was very expensive. So in avid use, those cell phones are maybe last 10 years. And then glioma to develop, we know that it takes several tens of years, 40, 50 years. Therefore, when we expose ourselves for 10 years, but glioma development takes 40, 50 years, there is not yet time for this exposure to affect this tumor that is happening later. There was simply no time for development. So we have to balance those two issues. One, potentially serious outcome like glioma, and then exposure to cell phone radiation, meaning not forbidding people to use this, but developing this technology better and limiting unnecessary exposures. What is better? Limit unnecessary exposures and be sort of at peace with this, that in 40, 50 years we will not have boom of gliomas, or this that we use wildly as we are using right now, cell phones, and rely on this that within first 10 years of habit use nothing was happening. So this is something like saying within first hour after midnight was no daylight, so apparently there is no daylight, but because it will be coming only 8 or 9 hours later. So this is this sort of issue to consider. So I think that we should look into not only population of healthy people, normal healthy people, but we should also think about those populations, what you were asking, people who might be compromised or might be weaker, like children, pregnant, people with impaired immune system. We all are different and we all may respond differently to this exposure because of our genetical predispositions and because of our environment. So it is no wonder that there might be some people who will be more sensitive, and those more sensitive might be, of course, those developing organisms like young children, or this developing organism in womb of mother, or this person who has not very, very good otherwise health and immune system and is not capable very well to combat with this radiation exposure or effects of these radiation exposures.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Young. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Chair. Dr. Tarswell, we just heard about the paramount importance of objectivity in scientific evaluation of technology from Dr. Lachinsky. And we know that when you publish an academic paper, the expert reveals all potential conflicts of interest as part of that publication. So in the interest of objectivity, could you please identify to the committee your business enterprises that you're personally involved in, if any, that depend on Wi-Fi, cellular signals, or other wireless technology to succeed?
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. I am a shareholder in a mobile gaming company called Hothead Games, based out of Vancouver, British Columbia. And I was an investor in a telemedicine company called Medio, which has subsequently been acquired.
Okay, thank you. And I'm just looking at Medio Corporation, which you say has been acquired. And a quote from one of their, I guess a flyer or their statement of purpose says, "With Medio, Canadian medical care joins the mobile revolution." And a quote on the statement of purpose for Hothead Games is to create and publish great games exclusively for mobile users. Do you have any interest in the 1 Minute Medical School?
I'm the creator of 1 Minute Medical School. That's okay. A YouTube channel with short videos on medical topics.
So these would be videos watched by people who are interested, laypersons or medical students, mostly on handheld devices. Is that right?
In terms of the composition of the audience, that I don't really know. Certainly there will be some viewership on mobile devices.
A lot of eggs in the wireless basket, that's for sure.
You could say so. I think it'd be hard pressed to find anyone who's not sort of intimately connected with wireless technology. I think if any of those are a significant conflict, that
they are. I'm just saying there might be a potential conflict. So my question is, would it be fair to say that any regulatory actions that the government might take regarding wireless communications or Safety Code 6 might significantly affect your business success in these enterprises?
Speculating. I suppose that's possible. I suspect not, but of course, it's hard to read the future.
Do you feel that?
But I certainly have to concede the possibility.
Thank you. So there is possibility of a potential conflict of interest when you present your credentials as an objective scientist to this committee, rather than in your other role as a business investor in a technology that depends on wireless.
Yes, and I think that it's extremely important to be as clear as possible and as honest as possible to the data and the evidence, which is why I've provided the documentation from the sources that I'm relying upon directly, so that the committee can peruse these in significant depth, rather than simply just relying on the poll quotes that I've assembled today.
Thank you. Dr. Luchinsky, what happens to humans when we face possible carcinogens or other environmental hazards that industry tell us are safe, for example, tobacco, BPA, asbestos, and we wait for scientific consensus before taking prudent measures to avoid that hazard or banning it?
Well, of course, if we are comparing, for example, with tobacco, if we are waiting for tens of years for getting final proof, during those tens of years, people are exposing themselves to tobacco or another agent that is considered as safe because we don't have yet final proof, and it means that they will get health problems during this 50 years or long period of time when we are waiting for final proof, final evidence. So there is this difference when we have a agent that might cause health problems and waiting for final proof when it is, we have to consider tens of years of waiting, then we should think this way, what is better, to implement precautionary measures right now and wait peacefully for those tens of years and waiting for this final evidence, or should we continue business as usual, and in case it appears that this health problem materializes, then during this tens of years of waiting, people will get this health problem, meaning large part of population. And
you agree that we
in case of cell phone radiation, of course, we are talking, and it's necessary always to consider 7 billion users.
Thank you. Would you agree that the world waited too long to act with regards to tobacco and asbestos and BPA?
I didn't hear your question at the beginning.
Would you agree that governments worldwide waited too long with regards to tobacco and asbestos and BPA to take precautionary measures?
Yes, absolutely so. I think that we should learn from this experience.
Very much.
Mr. Young, you got about 20 seconds.
20 seconds. Yeah. Okay. I'm going to ask Dr. Luchinsky, if you're familiar with the World Health Organization's warning list on agents that might cause cancer. They've maintained this list for 30 years. It includes 900 agents. And most of them on that list move up. over the years. Are you aware of any agent that has ever gone down the list? Were there any false alarms, or do they generally go up the list to high categories of higher danger?
I cannot give you no example. I don't know.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. Fry, go ahead.
Thank you very much. I want to thank our two presenters. I think that I want to pick up and follow on my colleague Terence Young's questions a bit, because I think he was asking a question, and I understand, Dr. Jachinski, that you didn't have these answers at your fingertips with regard to possible carcinogens that were moved off or down the list. But I think you gave your own examples at the very beginning, and I think what I heard you asking in your particular presentation, which I think is what we need to struggle with here as a committee, is the ethical sort of and moral need for us to look at a precautionary principle, or do we continue to follow what we saw with acid rain, with cigarettes, etc., where generations of people were harmed, died, got cancers, heart disease, etc., and the ecosystem was destroyed by acid rain? Should we? What is the ethical duty of parliamentarians or people who are in charge of the health and safety of a nation or communities to have a consideration of not just the clear and definite evidence, as Mr. Young was saying? Yes, there is some evidence, but not all. And as Mr. Tarswell was saying, this is eventually an ethical and a moral issue, I think, for us all. Do we err on the side of safety and precaution so that we do no harm or as little harm as possible, or do we wait for definitive studies? You actually... You talked about that, but you didn't give me an answer about what you think is the moral and ethical duty of people like us, parliamentarians, who actually have to create, make legislation or regulations that would keep us, our citizens, safe. You didn't answer that question yourself. You posed it a lot of times. I'd like to hear what you think.
Okay, there are two take-home messages from my presentation and what I wanted to present you with. First of all, we need unbiased, thorough review of scientific evidence that is currently available. This is, in most of the cases, not done, because majority of committees that are set up are having bias problems. So first of all, we need this good review of evidence, and this is what is most important for you, decision makers, that you can have unbiased evaluation of science. And this will be basis of your decision what to do. Then, when one committee was set up by IARC in such a way that there were very diverse scientific opinions included, so scientists with very different opinions, often opposite opinions, were invited to this working group. And what happened that during nearly 2 weeks of debate, we came out with conclusion that we have evidence of possible harm. We found limited evidence in epidemiology and limited evidence in animals that there is possibility of harm. None of the committees, which are those, for example, as I mentioned, ICNIR, which is a very important committee, Health Canada, and many other committees, none of them came to the same conclusion. Either committees come to the conclusion there is absolutely no harm, or they come to the conclusion there is really very serious harm. But when looking at composition of those committees, experts, we can see that either committees consist of experts having no harm opinion or harm opinion. So this is one problem. And second issue is that once you have this kind of round table, unbiased evaluation of science, then is this moral, ethical question. Should business go as usual, or should we protect population, take some steps, precautionary steps, because we don't know for sure, but we have indications, we have red flags that something might be happening. Should we protect population or not? And in this moment, we may, I would suggest, to look at our past. We should not forget about our past and learn from our history. We should learn from tobacco, we should learn from asbestos, we should learn from DDT and from many, many other miraculous agents that we first developed. Humanity thought this is really fantastic chemical, fantastic application, we can use it fully to advance our goals, and later on we had to wait for tens of years to find out if there is some problem. We should learn from this past, and when we see that there are some red flags, we should use precaution and precautionary principle.
Sure, you answered my questions. I just wanted to ask Dr. Tarswell a question. Are you a researcher, Dr. Tarswell?
My main areas of publication are functional brain imaging and psychiatric disorders, and the interaction with medically unexplained.
I'm trying to get to my question. So, in other words, you sort of researched your presentation to us, looking at glioma, because that's not your area of expertise. I'm just wondering, glioma is not the only thing we need to look at. We saw and heard today in a presentation of a researcher herself who had clear indication on slides of clumping of her cells after a 10-minute exposure. Now, clumping of her cells doesn't lead to glioma or other blood diseases. It could easily lead to thrombosis, et cetera, and especially if she travels a lot or she sits a lot. Those are clear things she has to think about. So we've got other areas in which we need to look at the broader amount of harm that could possibly be done. And I think my question then is, have you looked at all of those areas that people have suggested could be a problem, especially in children and in vulnerable populations with regard to exposure to these radio frequencies and Wi-Fi? What do you have an answer for that? I have about 30 seconds for your answer. 10 seconds? 11? Well, 9?
Just give a brief answer, sir.
Okay.
So the brief answer is no, I have not examined the entirety of the scientific literature on harms.
Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Lizon, 7 minutes. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Dr. Tarswell and Professor Leszczyński. And thank you for appearing at the committee, especially Professor Leszczyński. I think it's after midnight in Helsinki, if that's where you are.
Yes, it is Friday already.
Yeah, it is. It is. The question I have is, let's look at two scenarios. First, there is no effect on human health, therefore we're okay. But look at the other scenario, and you made comparisons to different, to smoking, to asbestos. Well, we have to, we all know that the population that was affected by smoking or by asbestos was only a fraction of the total population. In case of cell phones, when we look at the scenario that there is a serious problem here, it's a huge number of people. It's in many countries, it's I don't know, 70-80% of the population that use some kind of wireless devices that will be cell phone or have working area with Wi-Fi, etc., etc. Therefore, if there is a serious issue, do you have any estimates if there is a bomb down the road, how big it is going to be?
I do not have right now estimate, but yes, we may talk about potentially large problem. You said large population is exposed. Yes, right now there is over 7 billion of cell phone users. You can imagine that in Finland we have total population of slightly over 5 million and we have over 6 million of cell phone connections. Therefore, it is really, really very saturated. Humanity is very saturated with those devices. But at the same time, we have to remember that we all are different. Therefore, we may respond differently to this radiation. Not every smoker got lung cancer. And this we have to consider also with exposures to cell phone radiation. Therefore, those who are saying, and they are very often shown different kind of plots, that there is a dramatic increase in number of cell phones in the world, and there is not very much increase, if at all, in brain cancer. First of all, we are talking about first 10 years, what I already mentioned, 10 or 15 years of avid use, what is in comparison with development of glioma for 40, 50 years, what is not yet indicating what will happen. And another problem is this, that since not every smoker got lung cancer, possibly also not every cell phone user will get brain cancer if this radiation exposure will indeed be finally proven, ultimately proven that it causes this. So therefore it is not possible to expect this kind of thing, that we have a huge boom in cell phone numbers, that we should expect huge boom in brain cancers. It is not so.
If you were to advise the committee on the precautionary measures, what would your advice be? Because we did hear from the previous witness, Dr. Miller, I think he stated that really there is no safe level of radiation because it's the strength of radiation and it's also a time of exposure. Therefore, what would your advice be? How should we proceed?
This is very difficult to say right now because we don't know what would be this cut-off level. We don't have enough good studies for this sort of research to find out what is safe level or cut-off level where majority of population is not affected. We don't have this kind of studies. We didn't do this kind of human experiments where we could see that if we expose people to certain level, nothing is happening, and if we go above this level, something is happening. We don't have such studies, not at all. Even though for tens of years we did research in this area, we don't have such studies, because those studies mean that we should take people exposed to cell phone radiation, take samples, biochemical samples, and analyze their content and see what on molecular level is happening. We have only three this type of studies done in humans so far with 7 billion users. So this shows what kind of problem we are facing. We don't do correct research to find out what's the problem. Very often we are doing gimmicks.
In your view, personal view, lowering the level would be the good first step or no?
Yes, it would be a good step. Although I cannot tell you honestly how much we should lower this level. But only the fact that people using regular cell phones, like you and me, what we bought from shop, and when we go to shop, we assume this is safe phone, what I'm buying off the shelf, because government is watching after this. And after 10 years of using this cell phone, I'm increasing my risk of getting brain cancer. Something is wrong there. Meaning, safety standards are not protecting
you. Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate certainly the time you take, and for a professor in Finland, thank you very much for working well into the evening. So that'll do it for today. Meeting adjourned.